My name is David Livingston. I'm an independent researcher. I manage a website where I sort of feature my literature and my writings, which is ordoabtao.ca. I've written about 7 books now, mostly focused on the history of the occult and how it has shaped our civilization in ways that has not been fully acknowledged by mainstream historians. One of the key aspects of that tradition is that it's a Gnostic interpretation of religion, which means that it flips good and evil backwards. So like the Christian Gnostics, in the example, for example, they regard God the Creator as being an evil God who wants to suppress humanity by imposing his rules, whereas Satan, Lucifer, is a liberator who wants to teach man and save him from the oppressive creator by leading them to knowledge of themselves, knowledge of magic, and things like that. So they are Satanists, but they are not atheists. So although they are Satanists, they still believe in the truth of Bible prophecy, except they have different expectations of those outcomes. So they are pursuing to fulfill what has been prophesied. In fact, they're trying to, quote unquote, accelerate it, which is what we're seeing recently in our time, by doing whatever is necessary to force the advent of what's been prophesied. So what's interesting is that the same expectations are shared for the most part between Christianity, Judaism, and Islam. So Islam as well has an expectation of the return of Jesus, of Gog and Magog, of Armageddon, and so on and so forth. So what seems to be happening, which is what my thesis, is that those expectations are being deliberately manipulated. In particular, in the Islamic world, there is a tradition of this belief in a figure called the Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I. And he is supposed to be some kind of savior figure, but who precedes the return of Jesus. So Jesus is the real Messiah, but he's supposed to sort of wake up the believers just before Jesus returns, and then to join him in the fight against the unbelievers. But the reality is that in Islam, so there's the Quran, which is the scripture, but there's also collections of observations and teachings of the prophet that have been preserved in various what are called called hadith or traditions. And so there's different books, collections of them, that are considered to have different degrees of authenticity. And the most authentic are two, which is the what's called Sahih Bukhari and Sahih Muslim. And so the Mahdi is not mentioned in either of those collections, and it's not mentioned in the Quran. But it's become Muslims are so ignorant in our time that they assume that the Mahdi is an orthodox belief. So I've cited a survey that was conducted by the Pew Research Center, and I can't remember what their statistic was, but it's some huge number of Muslims today, something like 70% of Muslims in the world today, believe that the Mahdi will appear in their lifetime. And the warning that I've been issuing is that the Mahdi happens to be equated by New Agers with the Messiah that they're expecting. So New Agers are expecting this Messiah, you know, we should understand to be the Antichrist, who they equate with all the other Messiahs of the other religions. So they call him Maitreya, but he's supposed to be equal to Jesus, Buddha, Maitreya, so on and so forth, and they equate him with the Mahdi. So what you find is that there's certain those groups that are kind of most at the fringe of Islam that come clearest and closest to alignment with the New Age movement, particularly some fringe Sufi movement. They all advance or very almost focus on the idea of the Mahdi. There's one character in particular who's really problematic. His name is Imran Hussein, and he's gained quite a bit of popularity over the last couple of decades, because the essential problem in the Islamic world is that largely through Saudi influence, discussion of politics has been de-emphasized. So the Saudi government needs to prevent political discussion in their country, because it would inevitably lead to criticism of the regime. So through the mouthpieces of their state-appointed scholars, they have taught their followers that politics is a marginal topic, not of central interest. More of a concern is to learn how to quote-unquote properly worship. So this is why they focus on all the sort of performative aspects of the religion, on how to pray properly, how to fast properly, and all kinds of details about that are really, really ritual based. So there's very, very little discussion to dissect and investigate to understand the political arrangements in the world, so that Muslims can sort of learn to navigate through them. And so there's a huge vacuum as far as having intelligent critics in the Islamic world to decipher what's happening. So he happens to be a very rare voice, and because it's so rare, he's mistaken for being insightful. But what he does is that basically he focuses on what he likes to call Islamic eschatology, and one of his main focuses is the idea of the return of the Mahdi. But it just so happens that he's aligned himself with Alexander Dugin. The whole mission of Alexander Dugin. Dugin is a central character in the history of the occult that I uncover in my books. So, one of the most important occult trends of the 20th century is what's called the Polaire Brotherhood, who appeared, I believe it was in the 20s or 30s. They believed that they were in contact with an oracle they called the Oracle of the Astral Force, which they believe issued from Shambhala. It's a group that was a confluence of most of the occult trends of the time, like AMORC, which is the American Rosicrucian movement, the Martinist movement, and so on and so forth. And so Dugin shapes his political philosophy as a sort of a revival of the Polaire belief system. And so what he's striving for is to create, in fact, this is interesting. So Dugin says, I'm going to paraphrase him, but he uses the word, he basically explains that the end times is not a prophecy, it's a task. So basically, it's a blueprint that we need to follow and bring about. So he's working to bring about what he calls the empire of the end times. And that's all based on his sort of like various synarchist beliefs. They believe in the prophecy of Nostradamus, who's going to bring about the what they call the Grand Monarch. And they believe that Putin is that Grand Monarch. So his plan is to create a Eurasian empire, as he divides the world between an Atlanticist bloc and a Eurasianist bloc. And what's interesting is that he's based this on the teachings of Carl Schmitt. And Carl Schmitt he's referred to as the crown jurist of the Third Reich. When the Nazis basically caused the fire in the Reichstag to blame it on the communists to then seize power, it was Carl Schmitt who articulated the basically legal excuses to claim that it was a state of emergency, or what he called a state of exception, which justified Hitler seizing dictatorial powers. What's curious is that Carl Schmitt was also derived his ideas from the Kabbalah, and he was a close friend of Leo Strauss, who is the godfather of the neoconservatives. So, of course, it's well known that neoconservatives are the architects of what they call a clash of civilizations. This was articulated by Samuel Huntington, and he predicted that beyond the Cold War, the world would be divided in what he calls civilizational blocks, and one, so mostly based on religion. So you'd have like an Islamic block, a block made up of former Catholic nations, and one, several others, but primarily another one made up of the Eastern Orthodox Church. So basically, extrapolating from there, Dugin, because this is another point that's interesting, Dugin explains that he proposes that he himself and those who follow his doctrine are required to oppose the West, or the Atlanticist bloc, as he calls it, not because of any sort of innate hatred, but because it's fate. Since he is born in the East, he is required to fulfill his national destiny just as much as those in the Atlantis, in the Atlantic bloc, are required to do theirs. So Dugin basically has been working for the unification or the creation of the sort of Eurasian bloc, which again follows exactly Huntington's prescriptions, but just as a mirror image of it. And so one of the goals is to incorporate or to have them, because of course there's numerous Muslim states, all the stans as they call them, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, the states of Central Asia, to have them join this Eurasian bloc with the Eastern Orthodox. And so one of the means of doing that is by exploiting the idea of the Mahdi, and a person like Imran Hussein seems to be a key agent in doing so.
Mm. Yeah, what about Dugin though? Because I noticed recently he was interviewed as part of the Victory Day celebrations in Moscow on RT, and he was asked if there were any world leaders, first of all, who he celebrated and thought were fantastic. The first one, I mean, you know, there were a few, including Trump at the end, but the first one he mentioned as the most outstanding in the world was President Xi of China. Right. Now, we know that China is actually an authoritarian country. If you go there, people are very afraid to speak their mind, particularly if it's critical of the way the country's run. It's been a very successful authoritarian system under the Chinese Communist Party, which has adopted a lot of capitalism as part of its creed over the last few decades. And it certainly is not a place where people are free. They're very much managed. So I thought it was a bit strange that he should choose China, because China is, you know, they're basically sitting there waiting. It's run by a cult, effectively. They've been very successful in corralling their people into cities, a much lower quality of life, and to be incredibly economically productive, almost like, you know, sort of rabbits in a cage or something. But anyway, what do you make of Dugin saying that Xi is his favorite world leader?
Well, I think you find that surprising because you presume him to have some kind of humanitarian values, but Dugin is a Satanist. Right, so that's the whole point of what Dugin has been orchestrating, is by exploiting. And I wonder to what extent he's responsible for it, because you look at, you know, the way that the United States has been manipulated the last 30 years has been by dividing it on bipartisan lines between liberals and conservatives. Right? This is what a lot of people a lot of people confuse the left with liberalism. So liberals have been identified as the left, so they make it out to be a left-right debate, but it's actually liberalism against conservatism. So the conservative movement is actually an international movement, which is the part of the Fascist International, and Dugin is an essential key figure in it. His two mentors were two synarchists, occult fascists. One of them was Raymond Abellio, who was friends with Antoine Pinet, who was the founder of two crucial organizations. One of them was the Bilderberg Movement. And then a year apart, he founded what's called the SECL, the Circle, the Pinet Circle, which has become the umbrella organization of the Fascist International. So, you know, the divide in the United States starts with the arrival of Fox News in the United States, and that was basically a CIA operation that began when Roy Cohn, who is Donald Trump's mentor, introduced Rupert Murdoch to Ronald Reagan. And so basically ever since that time, they've been feeding the sort of hysteria, particularly targeting the Christian, what has become the Christian right. The development of the Christian right, again, is a fascist conspiracy that goes back to the 1930s in the United States, with organizations like the Liberty League, the American Manufacturers Association, the America First Committee, American Security Council, who basically began to exploit Christianity to their service. And then, so that base has been exploited by Fox News and cultivated to a point now where we can see what it's resulted in. It made it possible for a buffoon like Donald Trump to get elected. And much of that success can be attributable to Dugin, because he is the one who orchestrated the campaign, the Russian campaign, to support his election. So it's important here that the Russian campaign was not, as people dismiss it, it seems to be largely dismissed now, and there's some confusion. When in reality, it was a Mossad operation that worked through Russian agents. So it appeared to be a Russian campaign, but it was actually an Israeli operation. And it began in 1987 when Roy Cohn again convinced or began working to convince Donald Trump to run for president. And it's that summer that they first introduced him to the Russian ambassador and the Russian ambassador, Soviet ambassador. Soviet ambassador invited him back to Russia, and I guess that's where Trump probably first got his briefing, because it was a month later that working with Roger Stone that he took out a full-page ad in New York Times listing the various Soviet talking points and hinting that he was going to be running for president. So I'm all saying that just because, you know, it's a real question for me how far back this manipulation goes and where does it come from. But you can see that this sort of like bipartisan divide in the United States between conservatives and liberals goes back a long time. But that's precisely what now that Dugin has his man in the White House, he's fully exploiting it. In fact, you can see most of the articles that he's been writing these days, a lot of it just sort of celebrating the death of liberalism. And there's a lot of signs that, you know, he's not too far off the mark. And the other point is that what's interesting is that Dugin is also advancing the same cause that Henry Kissinger had started. And that's the idea of a multipolar world order. So the purpose of attacking the United States, even attacking the United States as a globalist power, is not really, it's a sort of a sleight of hand. It's not really to criticize globalism, but really to remove the superior power of the United States to suggest that we need to arrive at a new world order based on an agreement between numerous powers, or to create what they call, what Kissinger called, a multipolar world order. So the whole purpose of Dugin's jargon, none of it has to do with any of his sincere concerns for any kind of humanitarian sympathies. It's purely a play towards achieving the same goal that has been advanced by the neoconservatives, which he shares, but again, in the mirror version of it.
Right. Well, look, Dugin, it describes himself as a philosopher. He's described around the world as a philosopher. You describe him as a Satanist. What evidence do you have for that?
Well, I mean, where do you want to start? So basically, where he got to start, he got to start in a group of Satanists, basically right fascist Satanists called the Uzinsky Circle, and that's where. So this was in Soviet times. This is where he first got introduced to the teachings of René Guénon in particular, Julius Savola, who was another satanic fascist. And the one who introduced him to Aleister Crowley was Christian Boucher, who was apparently the head of the OTO in France. All of them are connected back to a group called GRECE, which is GRCE. It's an acronym that stands for Camera Grupma. Basically, it's a group for studying Indo-European heritage, which means Aryan heritage, which again is linked to the Fascist International. So Dugin has like every possible connection you can conceive. He is friends with Syed Hussein Nasser. Syed Hussein Nasser is a very highly respected, I believe, a Georgetown professor, Iranian professor, friends with the Aga Khan, very close, long-time friends with the Aga Khan. Nasser is apparently the current leader of a Maremia, a Sufi sex cult. It's a cult that was founded by Fritjof Schwoon, who is a disciple of René Guénon, and who was outed for various forms of sexual and child abuse. The reason why they call themselves Maremia is because they're named after Miriam, which is the Muslim name for Virgin Mary. And so basically it's a kind of cult based on the veneration of Virgin Mary, which he equates with the Shekinah of the Kabbalah. He's also friends with Claudio Muti, who was a Gladio operative. Claudio Muti was also quote unquote emir of this group called the Mirabitun. The Mirabitun was another pseudo Islamic cult founded by a guy named Ian Dallas, who was friends with people like Ernst Jünger and Albert Hofmann. So Ernst Jünger again is a leading figure, one of the several leading figures of the German conservative revolution. He was friends with Carl Schmitt, who was friends with Leo Strauss. He was his secretary, personal secretary was Armin Müller, who was a mentor to Alain de Benoist, who was Dugin's mentor. And Alain de Benoist is the guy who founded the French New Right and the Grace movement. Dugin was also friends with Luc Jouret. Luc Jouret was the founder of the suicide cult called Solar Temple. So it became notorious when, I can't remember what year it was, maybe in the 80s, when a number of its followers committed suicide in a town in Switzerland and just here in Quebec. So the Solar Temple group, basically members were associated with an order called the Green Order, or the Lucifer Gesellschaft, as they call themselves. It's it means the Lucifer Society, or who formed the Luciferian International, and they claim to have derived from the merger of the Thule Society, which was the group that originated the Nazi Party, and the Polaire Brotherhood that I was talking about earlier.
Right. Let's just move on to talk about, I think you kind of made your case about Dugin pretty well. Look, let's look at Gaza for a minute, because this is getting more and more horrific. by the hour almost. We're now looking at starvation, pictures coming back from Gaza of very emaciated individuals, and it's particularly harrowing to see pictures of starving children. And but one thing I notice is that there is really little or no spiritual dimension, no religious dimension, no understanding or interest in the religious side of what's going on down there. So I wonder why you think that might be, and if someone is scratching their head like I am, wondering why not, what you can say to sort of try and fill in some of the gaps, because almost all of the mainstream media coverage, I mean, you've explained in a way why this is a bit of a minefield, how you might help people to understand what that spiritual dimension to what's going on, this genocide we're watching right now is.
Yeah, so basically this is why in my recent book on Zionism, the subtitle is The History of a Jewish Heresy. So it what throws people off is that Zionism is sort of put forward as a, you know, most people don't really know what's going on, but the few people who come close to understanding recognize that Zionism is not a religious movement, but a nationalist movement. And that's only partly correct. It's a Gnostic movement. So it's an anti-traditional Jewish, it's a movement against traditional Judaism. So not to overcomplicate the story, but basically, you know, what's happened is that for centuries, Jews lived in ghettos and followed the religion of Judaism, and in particular, and so let's say that's the case in Europe at least.
Look, I hate to interrupt you, David, but there is this aspect of Judaism which has been seeking to return to Jerusalem. I mean, literally, you know, since the time of the destruction of the first temple, there's the Amidah prayer, which is prayed in synagogues, where they say, I mean, literally, that's been going for like 3,000 years, that we want to go back to Jerusalem. So there's got to be some kind of course, spiritual aspect to Zionism.
It's central to the whole point of Judaism is the belief that they're still waiting in the Messiah. Right, this is a traditional belief in Judaism. They're expecting the return of the Messiah, that they will be returned to the promised land, that the Messiah will come, that they rebuild the third temple, and that they will be rulers of humanity. That's Judaism. Right. The problem is that how is that interpreted? So traditionally, there's always been there's what's called the three oaths, and one of the three oaths is that it's strictly, explicitly forbidden for Jews to actively colonize the Promised Land, because it's considered a heresy. It's considered blasphemous. It's considered trying to force the hand of God. And that's what Zionists are doing.
That seems to me to be the key. So this is a prayer. God, bring us back. The problem with the sort of political wing of Zionism is that they have brought this into the religion okay, God is taking too long, so it's time to pick up a gun.
Right. So what's key is that's why Judaism, Zionism is born out of heresy of Judaism. So that's why I'm saying that until the late 1700s, in Europe at least, Orthodox Judaism was a fairly homogeneous tradition, or what's the word? Unified tradition. And you get a person, basically Moses Mendelssohn came along, who was friends with various members of the Illuminati, and according to the research of Rabbi Marvin Antelman, Moses Mendelssohn was regarded as a successor of Shabbatai Zvi, and he's the one who basically opened the way for the creation of Reform Judaism. So this is why you have this new Judaism which dares to go against traditional Judaism. So and the fact that they are Sabbateans, what's the main teaching of Shabbatai Zvi was that with the arrival of the Messiah, which he claimed to be, the rules of the Torah no longer applied. So they threw out the Talmud in favor of the Zohar. So the Zohar is what they follow. They reject the laws of the Bible, but they hold to the same prophecies. So that's why what you see is the creation of is an intent to colonize Palestine towards the creation, towards fulfilling Bible prophecy without following any of the rules of the Bible. And on the contrary, you see actions which are, I would say, overtly Luciferian in terms of their, you know, open malice. Because it's exemplary of their rejection of the Jewish legal, you know, Jewish morality.
You've given us a bit of context there, as to particularly on the Jewish side. What about the Islamic side? I mean, we know from what you were saying earlier on that, you know, there are some problems with Islamic eschatology, the way that they Muslims see this sort of thing. Is there anything that you can say to elucidate it for us? What is the correct way to read this, for as far as you're concerned, from the Muslim scriptures?
Yeah, so it's a little complicated. So the problem is that, you know, ever since, so, you know, the Zionists collaborated with the Arabs of Arabia to organize the Arab revolt to help overthrow the Ottoman Empire. So the Ottoman Empire was a traditional Islamic civilization which had existed since the 1400s, even earlier than that, but it was the conquest of Constantinople in 1453. And then, so basically the Zionists arrange for the cut up of the Islamic world into several puppet states. So that's where you get places like Jordan, Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, and so on and so forth, and most importantly, Saudi Arabia. So Saudi Arabia was handed over to a long-standing British agent. It's a family, the Saud family, which had had already very close relationships with the British for decades before, perhaps even further back. And that's why Saudi Arabia has been serving ever since as the main tool of colonization in the Muslim world. So most of the funding for the various, in fact, the movement to spread the Salafi or Wahhabi version of Islam taught in Saudi Arabia has been measured to be the largest propaganda campaign in history, larger than even the Soviet Union. Zionists using the Saudi state have been spreading this deviated version of Islam, and so it's been estimated in the United States they control as many as 80% of the mosques. So Muslims are basically in the dark these days. They don't realize to what extent they are being manipulated, and to what extent they've been estranged from classical Islam, and you know to what extent they've inculcated these sort of bizarre, diluted, literalist interpretations of Islam funded by Saudi Arabia. So what that's done is that it's produced a number of groups. So like I said, the most important one is Salafism, and the other one is Muslim Brotherhood. And that's been one of the most important organizations. So out of that, you get most of the political and terrorist organizations of the 20th century. So that's where you get people like Yasser Arafat. Yasser Arafat was a nephew of Mufti al-Husseini, who's known as Hitler's Mufti, who worked very closely with the Nazis and the Muslim Brotherhood. And then most importantly, it was a member of the Muslim Brotherhood who founded Hamas. And this is classic. This is what's been happening throughout the century. It's constantly being the CIA has consistently exploited the Muslim Brotherhood in various places around the world to carry out their colonial objectives. The most famous one, of course, is in Afghanistan, where they work to undermine the power of the Soviet Union. And then again, the creation of Hamas. So I think it's a well-known fact. I hope it is. That Hamas was funded by Netanyahu. Netanyahu wanted to undermine the influence of the PLO. So going through Qatar, he funneled billions of dollars to Hamas. And that's their purpose is there to provide Israel with the pretext by committing these ludicrous acts of violence, like this airstrike that they did, which basically opens the way for Israel to commit genocide and have a cover story for it.
Okay, what about other Islamic countries? Because this is, to me, is the real story, what's going on in the world today from a journalistic point of view, is you've also got the Israelis over in, the Zionists over in India, firing drones into Muslim Pakistan. Basically Muslim countries all around the world, or places with Muslim majorities, even if they aren't actually run like somewhere like Iran as a Muslim state. It seems to be sort of spreading around. I mean, even in old Burma, like Myanmar, we've got the Israelis in there helping the government against the Rohingyas, who are being funded by Saudi Arabia. So this almost seems to have its tendrils in all sorts of parts of the world. And actually, at the fundamental basis of it is people's faith, people's religion.
Absolutely. That's how it always goes, right? Many come with my name. You're like, even the Bible says that, right? So first of all, India and Pakistan are a real sore spot. They're really, India, Pakistan, and Saudi Arabia are really the sources of the most problems in the Islamic world, the most corrupted doctrinal infections in the Islamic world. And the reason is because, of course, India and Pakistan were once part of the British Empire for the longest lasting Muslim part of the world that was under British occupation, going back to the East India Company, which was run by Freemasons. In fact, you know, this is all the stuff that I cover in my most recent book, which is called Divide and Conquer Muslims versus Islam. So there's this higher sort of Masonic history that goes back to building up these sort of sectarian movements in India and Pakistan that have resulted today. But the most important agent is a guy named Jamaluddin Al-Afghani. This is a guy who was born in Iran, which means that he would have been a Shia, but he called himself Afghani so that no one would suspect him of being such. So he basically sort of paraded himself as a Sunni. And then this guy was active in so many places. So first he goes to Afghanistan, where he, this is interesting too, because he goes to Afghanistan where he's advising the Emir of Afghanistan, who also happened to hire Josiah Harlan, who was who inspired the story, Rudyard Kipling's story of the man who would be king. I don't know if you know that movie, starring Sean Connery and Michael Caine.
Well, I mean, that film is particularly memorable for the scene
because of the
where
Masonic scenes in it.
Well, that's right, where they do a sort of secret handshake, and they go, "Oh, right, you're part of our cult," and they know they're from completely different parts of the world. And I think, I mean, I've seen this sort of thing take place where you've got interchangeable secret signs which can go completely across, say, for example, from witchcraft to Freemasonry, and someone will recognize a sign, give a secret word, you know, whether it's one of them. I was told by a former Freemason was, "How old is your mother?" And this is could be seen as an innocent question, but often, of course, what he's really talking about is your mother lodge. And the Mother Lodge might be 300 years old or something. And so that would be a perfectly normal response. But these are all kind of code words and code expressions interchangeable between different cults. Right. So that's what I remember from the film particularly.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's all kinds of other hidden symbolism, which is fascinating. But basically the idea that these people were, you know, supposed descendants of Alexander the Great. And there's a lot of history there has a lot of significance for the occult. But anyway, so Afghani then leaves Afghanistan, and then he becomes, his disciples create the first Masonic lodge in Iran, which becomes responsible for what's called the Iranian Revolution. And they also his disciple on Afghani's orders assassinated Shah Nasruddin, and I think it was the year 1896 or somewhere thereabouts, which opened the way for the Persian Constitutional Revolution, which created the modern state of Iran. Then he goes, then he's hanging, the same group of disciples are hanging around in Turkey, where they are part of the various of the Masonic network there, including connections with the Young Turks. And the Young Turks was a movement that was created by Domne crypto Jews who were descendants of the original followers of Shabtai Zvi. In fact, it's interesting that it's Rudolf von Sabetendorf. He learned Kabbalah from the same Jews, the Kabbalistic Jews of Salonika, because Salonika was the hub of the Young Turks, before he came back to Germany to found the Nazi, the Thule Society, which founded the Nazi Party. So then Afghani was in Egypt, and there he's responsible for founding a native Masonic lodge called the East Order of the Eastern Star. And so his disciples there again were responsible for what's called the Urabi Revolt, which gave Britain the pretext to invade the country, after which point, basically, Britain retained control over the country for a few decades. It was at that point that he was in contact with several of Blavatsky's disciples. One was a Jewish actor. His name was James Sunua, and his girlfriend, Lydia Pashkov. And they were friends of Blavatsky's publisher, was Mikhail Katkov, who was a Russian publisher. And so Afghani was going back and forth, but he's traveling all over the place. So several times going back and forth and conspiring with Katkov in Russia as well, to working for the Russians. And so there's this historian, his name is K. Paul Johnson, and he's put forward the case that Afghani was a quote unquote ascended master to Blavatsky. So one of these occult figures that she communicated with, through which she gained her occult teachings. Though I've also pointed out that I found that there's a photo that was published of, so Saint Yves d'Alvey. So when you talk about Alexander Dugin and the Polaire Brotherhood, its origins and is in the Synarchist movement. So everything that Dugin's today is an extension of the Synarchist movement. His two mentors that I talked about, Jean-Paul Verlescu and Raymond Abellio, they're sort of some of the chief exponents of Synarchism in recent times. And Synarchism was founded by a guy named Alexandre Saint-Yves d'Alvin. And he was introduced to the legend of Agartha and Synarchy by a guy who went by the name of Haji Sharif. And if you look at a photo of Haji, this so-called Haji Sharif, it's Jamal Afghani. So this is like just a brief hint of all the areas where Afghani exercised his influence. So he was an ascended master of Blavatsky, who's the godmother of the New Age movement. Haji Sharif, who inspired the legend of Agartha in Saint Yves d'Alvey. Those two traditions basically together contributed to Ariel Sophy, which produced the doctrines of the Nazi movement. And simultaneously, Afghani was celebrated as probably the most important reformer of Islam in modern times. But, you know, there's British intelligence documents that show that he was also going by the name of Jamal Effendi, where he was basically working as an agent of the Baha'i movement. And he was in contact with the Aga Khan, which is not too far apart. So we have to remember that the Aga Khan is the hereditary leader of the age-old assassins of the, when are the assassins? In the 900s, 1000s? And the assassins are important because they were a cult that pretended to be Shia Muslim, but in reality, they were a Gnostic cult that used 9 degrees of initiation to remove their followers from Orthodox Islam to a heretical nihilistic doctrine. So this whole legend is famous in Freemasonry. It's believed that the Templars were in contact with the assassins, and presumably it was from them that they learned their teachings and brought them to Scotland, which is how Scottish Rite Freemasonry was produced. So just to give you a glimpse, so that's what happened is that it was, first of all, Afghani had two important followers. One of them was Muhammad Abdu. Muhammad Abdu became the Grand Mufti of Egypt. And that's basically how the British took over the University of Al-Azhar and began to effectively rewrite Islamic law. And then Abdu's disciple was Rashid Rida. And Rashid Rida is another really important character who played in so many ways in different aspects of British colonial schemes. And he was the one who was responsible for the merger of the Salafi tradition that Afghani started and Saudi Wahhabism, because he worked closely with Ibn Saud, the founder of the Saudi state. So that's why when the Muslim Brotherhood was founded, I think it was the year 1928, the founder, Hassan al-Banna, claimed that he was founding a movement which was based on the Salafi Salafi doctrines, but eventually received the funding of Saudi Arabia, and that's pretty much what you see. When you go to Pakistan now, the collaboration with the British and the Saudis goes back about 150 years and maybe more. And so it's often through the influence of Saudi Arabia that the various sectarian movements in India and Pakistan were developed. So yeah, this is where it's really important. So now the Pakistan and India were both parts of a single British Raj, right? A single British entity. So you had two movements that arose to fight, work towards independence. So you had the Indian National Congress, and that was founded by a Theosophist, a follower of Blavatsky and Annie Besant. And so the whole makeup of the initial, the International Congress, the INC, was made up almost entirely, the leadership, it was made up mostly of Freemasons, and its leadership were mostly Theosophists. Gandhi himself was a disciple of Blavatsky, and particularly very close to Annie Besant. And they all collaborated with a parallel movement, an Islamic movement called the All India Muslim League. And the All India Muslim League was founded by a guy named Syed Amir Ali, who was an Indian scholar, but he was actually a Shia. He's the one who had reproduced the claim that Freemasonry was derived from the Assassins. The first president of the All India Muslim League was the Aga Khan Aga Khan III. But it's basically the Aga Khans were always part of this development. So the Aga Khans were very much at the backbone of the resurgent of this pseudo-Islam in India. So another important leader of the All India Muslim League was a guy, his name is Muhammad Iqbal. He's known as, he has sort of like a respectful name where he's known as Allama Iqbal. He's considered the intellectual father of Pakistan, but in reality, he was educated in England. He was a Hegelian, and he had this whole sort of convoluted doctrine that was based on his belief that the true evolution of Islamic philosophy began with the Assassins and culminated with the Baha'i movement. And he was also a member of another British creation, which was the Ahmadiyya movement. But the first important leader of the All India Muslim League was Muhammad Ali Jinnah, who was the founder of Pakistan. And he, again, was a Theosophist and a disciple of Annie Besant. And that just gives you a taste of a sampling of some of the various concoctions that have been created through British and occult influence in the Islamic world. And this is something that Muslims are almost entirely ignorant of.
Well, it's not just Muslims, David, is it? Because it would be nice to have some of this context in some of the coverage that we're seeing around by mainstream journalists today, it would be really, really good. And in fact, I think it's absolutely essential and necessary. But you've touched on quite a lot of cults there, particularly the religious cult of Freemasonry. And I know in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus makes it very clear in the book of Matthew in the New Testament that you should never swear an oath. Simply let your yes be yes and your no be no. And he adds a little sting in the tail. Anything else comes from the devil. So it's quite clear that at least Jesus, back in those times, was making it very clear that you should never ever get involved in these blood oaths. Fascinatingly, the Masonic initiation rites, almost all of them, and particularly I think it's the third degree, which is supposed to be the one where you get hit gently, supposedly anyway, right, on the head by a mallet, and you're supposed to fall back into a coffin as a ritual death, basically. And in fact, of course, this is a threat of death against the candidate. There's a lot of talk about Hiram Abiff, who was a Phoenician who was invited by Solomon to come and build his temple. And there's a lot of talk about Solomon's temple, too. So this is, it seems to me, hardly mentioned that this is what the Zionists plan to do. They do plan to rebuild Solomon's temple. And there it is, right in the middle of this Masonic ritual, going back 350-odd years, at least.
Right. Exactly.
I wonder, is there anything in Islam which does take a similar edict against these oath swearing and joining these cults?
Well, not that specifically, but there's a verse. What's interesting, and this is why I pointed out to Muslims, is that the first chapter of the Quran is sort of the equivalent of the Lord's Prayer. It's very short. The second chapter is the longest chapter, and the first 100 verses, most of it focuses on the Jews. So to show that the Jews were the first to have received the revelation, they were the first to receive extensive blessings from God, but speaks to their sort of repeated rebellion and blasphemies, which is effectively the story of the Old Testament. And then it introduces, after almost 100 verses, the claim that among them there's a group who apostatized, and they did so by learning magic from the sort of angels who were referred to as Harut and Marut. The Quran corrects that in reality they were learning magic from Satanists who attributed those teachings to Solomon. And the legend is that in Islamic tradition is that because in Islam, the teaching is that Solomon was able, I mean, same thing I think is in the Bible, is that Solomon was able to build a magnificent temple. It's supposed to be the most extraordinary temple in history with all kinds of scientific marvels. And but he was given control over jinn. So what's jinn basically is their spirit. There are non-material entities. This I think we've talked about this before. The idea of spirits is an idea that you'll find, I think, pretty much everywhere in the world. Western society is probably the only society who's rejected that belief. Instead, we have ETs. But these are beings that have free will. So the devil is apparently one of these beings, and he rebelled against God. So they're just not made of matter. They're made of, presumably, maybe energy or something like that.
Well, yeah, so anyway, we're talking, about angels and demons.
Right. So effectively what we call demons, but they're not born evil. It's just that they're not evil by nature. They have free will, and some of them are bad. So he was able to control these jinn, a number of them, to help him in the construction of his temple. And apparently they hid a number of magical books under Solomon's throne, so that when Solomon died, those books were discovered and were falsely attributed to him. So, but in parallel, a similar legend, well, the legend of Solomon's skill in magic survived in Judaism, right? So, this is why Apparently, the legend is that he was able to control the demons through a ring that had a sigil on it, which was this what they call a seal of Solomon, which was a six-pointed star, right? So the idea is basically that Solomon used demonic magic to be able to build the third temple through control of demons using the seal, the six-pointed star. And the idea is that the Masons have inherited the magical traditions of Solomon to now build the third temple.
Right. Well, look, also it's important to mention that just in the Old Testament tradition, the Jewish history, Solomon was a disaster. He started out really good, and in a way, it's for the Freemasons to celebrate Solomon seems to me to be a sort of
Gnostic.
It's almost as if, well, you don't know your Bible if you think Solomon was a great guy. Well, he was for a while. In fact, he did lots of writings, yeah. But he was very much a character that was, I mean, possibly it was these Phoenicians that just got him away from the original mission of Abraham.
Right. But the Masons are Gnostics, right? So the Masons, like, I think it was Dan Brown. Dan Brown wrote a book called The Lost Symbol. And so, you know, typical of his books, he has his that professor who was a specialist in symbols, and he goes on this treasure hunt to find the lost symbol. And what it ends with is that the lost symbol of Freemasonry is actually the Bible. But what Dan Brown explains is that it's not the Bible that you and I read. And he quotes William Blake to say something along the lines of, where you read white, we read black. You know, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, well,
that's
right.
They're following the same Bible, but they're following a Gnostic interpretation of it,
right,
where they regard Lucifer as the true God, and they regard the Creator as being an oppressive imposter.
Yeah, I think it was Bill Cooper in his Lansing talk. He talks about this idea of a cruel and vindictive God. Well, yeah, and so that's because you can't just do what you want and have total free will, because what it does, if you do exactly whatever you want, and you can be harming yourself, you can be harming others, and so we need to have a little bit of order around here.
Of course.
So also I wonder about the potential use of these kind of spiritual tools in the present conflict in the Middle East. I mean, I can remember reading Dennis Wheatley. He was a deception planner, an author, and I don't know, but I think probably a Freemason too. But if you can imagine the context of Freemasonry in Britain in the around the time of the between the wars and the Second World War, was very much embracing Christianity in its own way. I mean, it was saying, well, yes, you can be a Christian and a Mason. It's changed a lot nowadays. But he was talking about things like using the occult. So through feeding false information to astrologers they knew were trusted by people like Himmler and others who believed in that sort of thing in the Third Reich. Having, for example, a witchcraft ritual down in the New Forest to stop Hitler invading. Now, this may have had absolutely no real spiritual effect, but of course it has an effect on the minds, not only of the witches down in the New Forest doing their little ritual, thinking, right, yes, we are the people who are stopping Hitler invading. But it also, of course, has a very powerful effect in the minds of those who believe that these astrologers are telling them some sort of channeling this information from, you know, some kind of spiritual source, where actually they're just being fed it by British intelligence to wrongfoot the Nazis.
Yeah, so I
wonder if you think there's anything like that going on today, what there might be still.
You have to presume. You're going to look at a guy like Alexander Dugin. The entire basis of his world, his belief system is magical. So, in what ways he incorporated magic into his activities, I don't know. The Engels, which he's connected with as well too, right? It's a satanic neo-Nazi organization based on magic as well too. I mean, that this is what we're up against, right? Where it's a satanic Nazi cult that believes that magic is the knowledge of the tree of knowledge that they've been delivered to by Satan to come back.
But it, I mean, it's also, the thing is, it's also a hall of mirrors, isn't it? So you see, if you're really clever, what you can do is you can put Alexander Dugin out on the TV as if you really believe what he's saying. You think he's a great guru, where actually the idea is he's out there just to make you think that, and you don't believe him at all. You know, so there is all sorts of. Listen,
there's only so much we're going to be able to understand with their schemes. But the problem is we don't need to. What we need to do is we need to know what the truth is and work for that. We need to understand what justice is, what we need to do. We can't, it's the point is not to undermine and destroy what they're doing. The point is just to understand it enough so that we can liberate ourselves from their manipulations and their deceptions and hopefully save others from it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it seems to me that you, in a lot of this trying to fathom what they're up to, we lose the idea of simple facts like right and wrong.
Exactly. So that's what we ultimately should be focusing on. The right and wrong is very straightforward, and that's what we need to work on. We can't really worry too much about the not too much. We need to, you know, we need to be on our guard so that we're not deceived. But ultimately, it's not is if we stick by what's right, there's nothing they can do.
You mentioned you've got your latest book out. Can you just remind us of the title and just give us a bit of a summary?
Yeah, so it's called Divide and Conquer, Muslims versus Islam. It's a two-part book. And so it covers what I sort of summarized earlier. It's effectively, it shows how classical Islam was formulated in the first centuries, and then identified the various movements that arose to try to undermine it. So it goes back to the foundation of the Assassins, various Sufi tendencies, and then how those all evolved over time, and especially in our century, how in collaboration with various Western occult networks, numerous groups and reform movements were created to, first of all, overthrow the Ottoman Empire, which removed any obstacle to their infiltration, and then since then, to completely overtake the Islamic world and to progressively hijack it to a point where they could, ultimately what they're trying to do, because there's two aspects to the New World Order. There's a political side, which is, of course, you know, the political construct of having, like we said, a multipolar world order of a federated world state. And the other side is a one world religion, which is the belief that is going to be imposed on the rest of humanity in that new order. And it's intended to be sort of it's basically an extension of the Baha'i movement. And it suggests that all religions share enough to form a single faith. And so these various trends that have been created have all been working towards the interfaith movement, particularly groups like the Muslim Brotherhood and the Ismailis have been working behind the scenes to shape the current contemporary Islam in that direction.
Yeah, I think for many people trying to figure some of this stuff out, you know, you could switch on the 24-hour rolling news and there are talking heads gibbering away, not really explaining anything. But one thing that does come through is, you know, this idea of creating chaos in Gaza, an absolute horror hell show in the Holy Land. This, of course, you know, is going to hit you at a kind of almost like subliminal or unconscious level and repel people. You, I think, are one of the people that does understand the way that chaos can be used. Can you just, you know, finally, David, can you just explain what you think is going on there and how we can come to terms with what looks to be absolutely horrific evil and a creation of chaos in what is, you know, actually the cradle of civilization?
So Zionism is basically a Gnostic form of Judaism. So it's fundamentally Luciferian, which is why it doesn't, not only does it not abide by any sort of humanitarian sympathies, but it rejects them, and it adopts inhumane approaches as necessary for fulfillment of their bastardized version of fulfilling Bible prophecy. And so we know we live in a century where it's been very important because the Zionists first managed to, as I said, working hand in glove with the various reform movements in the Islamic world to overthrow the Ottoman Empire, which liberated Palestine from Ottoman control, which allowed them to create the Zionist state. And then since then have been progressively increasing their power. First of all, created the United Nations because the United Nations is to be the seat of the global government, which is what they believe is foretold, which is to have a seat in Jerusalem. Of course, you can see that they've been using Western powers, particularly the United States, to carry out their objectives by proxy. They've got puppet states installed across the Islamic world. And what we were seeing was, I think, to some extent, an attempt to accommodate public opinion and to try to disguise their actions to not invite excessive criticism. But I think what we're seeing now is an assurance, a level of confidence that they have arrived at a point where they no longer need to care. And I think that's the danger. And I think we're seeing that, especially in the Islamic world, with all the states basically just watching the debacle that's happening in Gaza without the slightest degree of criticism. And, beyond that, establishing or normalizing ties with Israel, as they refer to it. It shows that, the fact that this can happen under the world's eyes without really any kind of organized international condemnation, no sanctions, it shows you to the extent of how much the efforts over the last century has kind of power they've managed to secure over the last century. And so for me, the danger is that they feel confident enough to proceed without bothering with what the rest of you and I think. So it means that, what's in front of us is now more clear than ever. I think, it probably was, it was this powerful for a long time, but we were in denial. But now we're finally seeing what we're up against, and combating it is not going to be easy, and we have to recognize that. But this is what it all comes down to, right? This everything that's happening is a test from God, and it is the test from God. And we people look to each other and to look at what's in their bank account, what kind of a political power they have, to size what kind of effect they can have, as opposed to people see the extent of Zionist influence in the world and they wonder what can they do. And that's exactly the point. The point is that they will never gain the power that God has. God is waiting for believers in humanity to recognize that the power lies with Him, that the solution is they have to do their best effort, but the victory can only come when they plead for His help.
Wow. Yeah. And it's good to see here in Bristol, we've got an immense movement. Marches, very regular marches. One went past me the other day. I should have been on it, really. But even in a little village like Nailsworth in the Cotswolds, there's a whole crowd of people, 30 or 40 people stood in the middle of the town, with all the people driving past tooting for Palestine. So there is definitely something happening. A genuine grassroots movement of some kind, a peaceful movement of people. Particularly, I think what's brought more people out on the streets here, David, is the starvation methods that the Israelis are using now. There are some, aren't there, that are calling for action from countries like Iran. They should start destroying Israel. They should really go to war with Israel. What do you think of that?
Yeah, that's a ploy. Iran is another Western construct. Ayatollah was a British agent.
But what I'm saying is, I mean, surely that's a trap, isn't it? Isn't that the idea that?
No.
No.
We need to recognize that all political leadership in the world today is compromised, and we need to rely on ourselves. We need to put hope in ourselves, not like you know, how many jets or how big of an army some group has.
Okay, David Livingston, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Thanks again.